Patients are pleased to see me before their operation, but he looked terrified. I leant forward and lightly patted his hand. I told him that the operation really was a very simple one. I explained that we always had to warn people of the risks of surgery, but promised him that it really was most unlikely that things would go wrong. If I'd had sciatica for 6 months, I would have the op, I said. I wouldn't be happy about it, but I'd have it, although, like most doctors, I am a coward. Whether I managed to reassure him or not, I do not know. It really was a simple operation with a very low risk, but my registrar would have consented him earlier that morning, and the registrars, especially the American ones, tend to go over the top with informed consent and terrorize the poor patients with a long list of highly unlikely complications, including death. I mention the main risks as well, but stress the fact that serious complications with simple disc prolapse surgery, such as nerve damage and paralysis, are really very rare. I left the anaesthetic room to go to the meeting with the EWTD compliance manager. "I'll come back and join you," I said to my registrar over my shoulder as I left the theatre, though I thought that would scarcely be necessary, as he had done such operations before on his own. I went back to the meeting room, where my colleagues were waiting with the manager. She was a large and officious young woman with hennaed hair in tight curls. She spoke imperiously. "We need your agreement to the new rotor," she was saying. "Well, what are the options?" one of my colleagues said. "If they are to be compliant with the European Working Time Directive, your registrars can no longer be resident on call. The on-call room will be taken away. We have examined their diary cards. They are working far too much at the moment. They must have 8 hours sleep every night, 6 of it guaranteed uninterrupted. This can only be achieved if they work in shifts, like the SHOs." My colleagues stirred uncomfortably in their seats and grumbled. "Shifts have been tried elsewhere and are universally unpopular," one of them said. "It destroys any continuity of care. The doctors will be changing over 2 or 3 times every day. The juniors on at night will rarely know any of the patients, nor will the patients know them. Everybody says it's dangerous. The shorter hours will also mean that they will have much less clinical experience, and that's dangerous also. Even the president of the Royal College of Surgeons has come out against shifts. We have to comply with the law," she said. "Is there any choice?" I asked. "Why can't we derogate? Our juniors want to opt out of the EWTD and work longer hours than 48 hours a week and can do this by derogating. Everybody in the city opts out of the EWTD. My medical colleagues in France and Germany say they take no notice of the EWTD. Ireland has derogated for doctors." "We have no choice," she replied. "Anyway, the deadline for derogation was last week." "But we were only told last week about the possibility of derogation," I said. "Well, it's irrelevant anyway," came the reply. "The trust has decided nobody will derogate." "But that was never discussed with us. Does our opinion about what is best for patients count for nothing?" I asked. Her utter lack of interest in what I said was very obvious, and she did not bother to reply. I started to deliver an impassioned denunciation of the dangers of having trainee surgeons working only 48 hours a week. "You can send me an email setting out your views," she said, interrupting me, and the meeting came to an end. I went round to the theatres, where my registrar was starting the spinal case. He had done a fair number of these cases on his own before, and although not the best of my trainees in terms of operating ability, he was certainly one of the most conscientious and kindest juniors I had had for a long time. The nurses all adored him. It seemed safe enough to let him start and probably do all the operation himself. The patient's extreme anxiety had, however, made me anxious in turn, so I changed and went into the theatre, when usually I would have stayed outside in the red leather sofa room, readily available but not overlooking everything he did. As it was a spinal procedure, the patient, rendered anonymous by light blue sterile drapes, was lying anaesthetized face down on the table. A small area of skin over the lower spine exposed as a rectangle, coloured yellow by the iodine antiseptic and brilliantly illuminated by the big, dish-shaped operating light suspended on hinged arms from the ceiling. In the middle of this rectangle was a 3-inch incision through the skin and into the dark red spinal muscles, which were held open by steel retractors. "Why such a large incision?" I asked irritably, still enraged by the manager and her complete indifference to what I had said. "Haven't you seen how I do these? And why are you using the big bone rongeurs? That shouldn't be necessary at L5, S1." I was annoyed, but not alarmed. The operation had scarcely begun. The scan had showed a simple disc prolapse, and he would not yet have reached the more difficult part of the operation, which is to expose the trapped nerve root within the spine. I scrubbed up and came over to the operating table. "I'll have a look," I said. I picked up a pair of forceps and looked into the wound. A long, shiny white thread, the thickness of a piece of string, 4 or 5 inches long, came up out of the wound in my forceps. "Oh, Jesus fucking Christ!" I burst out. "You've severed the nerve root!" I threw the forceps onto the floor and flung myself away from the operating table to stand against the far wall of the theatre. I tried to calm myself down. I felt like bursting into tears. It is, in fact, highly unusual for gross technical mistakes like this to occur in surgery. Most mistakes during operations are subtle and complex and scarcely count as mistakes. Indeed, in 30 years of neurosurgery, I'd never witnessed this particular disaster, although I have heard of it happening. I forced myself to return to the operating table and looked into the bloody wound, cautiously exploring it, dreading what I might find. It became apparent that my registrar had completely misunderstood the anatomy and opened the spine at the outer rather than the inner edge of the spinal canal, and hence had immediately encountered a nerve root, which, even more incomprehensibly, he had then severed. It was an utterly bizarre thing to have done, especially as he had seen dozens of these operations done before and done many unsupervised on his own. "I think you've cut straight through the nerve. A complete neurotmesis," I said sadly to my dumbstruck assistant. "He'll almost certainly be left with a permanently paralysed ankle and a lifelong limp. That's not a minor disability. He'll never be able to run again, or to walk on uneven ground. So much for the mountain bike championships." We completed the rest of the operation in silence. I redirected the opening into the spine and quickly removed the disc prolapse without any difficulty. The simple and quick operation I had more or less promised him as he lay looking so frightened in the anaesthetic room earlier that morning. I went out of the theatre, where Judith, my anaesthetist for many years, joined me in the corridor. "Oh, it's so terrible," she said. "And he's so young. What will you tell him?" "The truth. It's just possible that the nerve is not completely cut through, and I suppose he might just recover. Though if he does, it will take months. To be honest, I doubt if he will, but I suppose there's some hope." One of my consultant colleagues passed by, and I told him what had happened. "Bloody hell," he said. "That's bad luck. Do you think he'll sue?" "I think it was reasonable enough for me to let my registrar start. He's done these operations before, but I got it wrong. He was less experienced than I realized. It really was staggeringly incompetent. But then I'm responsible for his operating." "Well, it's the trust that gets sued anyway. It doesn't really matter whose fault it was. But I misjudged his abilities. I'm responsible, and the patient will blame me anyway. He'd put his trust in me, not in the bloody trust. In fact, assuming he doesn't recover, I'll tell him to sue. My